Thank you very much, John. Well, it's been a couple of years since the lung emergency came out, and I want to give you some updated information about what's going on in the energy world and as it's going to affect all of us. And I just want to start out by reminding you about the, I'm not going to rehearse the whole peak oil story, but I do want to remind you that it is not about running out of oil. It's about what happens when we head down the slippery slope of depletion. And the important thing is to remember is that the complex systems that we depend on for everyday life start to get into trouble. And by complex systems, I mean very precisely the way we produce our food, the way we do commerce and trade, the way we do finance, the way we do transportation, etc. There have been a number of new subplots to the oil story that have developed since my book came out that are worth mentioning to you. And by the way, the price of oil has quadrupled since 2001 and roughly doubled since about the same time last year when it was in the, you know, coming out of the winter of 2006 and 7, the price was about $50-$60 a barrel, closed at $106 a barrel on Friday on the futures markets. New discoveries that are being trumpeted all the time by the people who, by the public relations people for the oil industry. New discoveries have been very, very skimpy. A lot of them are coming in places where the oil is discovered, but then we realize that it's going to be difficult, extremely expensive, perhaps impossible to produce. Many of you may remember the famous Chevron Jack discovery in the deep water in the Gulf of Mexico last year. They would have to run about 5 miles of pipe down through the ocean and then through about 5,000 feet of rock to get to that oil. That's going to be a very expensive proposition. It will probably never happen, in my opinion. There are two really big new stories in the, or new plot lines in the oil story. One is called the oil export crisis that is developing. And what this really means is that we've discovered in the last 18, 24 months that the export rates from the nations that send oil out of their boundaries to people like us, the importers, the export rates are going down at a steeper rate. They're declining at a steeper rate than the depletion rates of these countries. So if their oil is depleting at 3% a year, their export rates are going down between 7 and 11% a year. The depletion rate in the giant oil fields, which supply about half the world's oil, runs between 8 and 18%. Mexico is the poster child for the oil export crisis because their oil production relies for 60% of its product on the giant, the second largest oil field ever found, the Cantarell oil field, which is depleting at a minimum of 15% a year. And Mexico is the U.S.'s number three source of imports. Sometimes it's number two. It sort of swaps in and out with Saudi Arabia. And the depletion rate of 60% of their oil is 15% a year, so do the math. You know, within a decade, they're not going to be sending us any oil. We will lose our number three source of imports. That is something that you're not hearing in the media. You're not hearing it from your political leaders. It's important to remember, we have a comprehensive failure of leadership in America. It's not just a failure of George Bush. It's a failure in business. It's a failure in academia. It's a failure in the media. It is a thoroughgoing failure. Saudi Arabia is about at the same point that Texas was at oil-wise in 1970. It is past peak. The oil export crisis is happening because, largely because the exporting nations are using more of their own oil. Their populations are growing. They're buying more cars. Russia saw a 50% jump in the number of cars sold just in 2006 over 2007. In many cases, they need more oil energy to lift the remaining oil out of the ground. Russia had its absolute oil peak in the 1980s. Then when the Soviet Union collapsed, their oil production collapsed because they were running it at full bore and destroying their equipment in order to get hard currency for the only thing that they could sell overseas, which is their oil. And after they recovered a bit from that and got their equipment going again, they reached a secondary peak that was lower than the original peak in the 80s. They are now entering a permanent decline. The North Sea is an interesting case. You know, half of it is owned by the UK, population 60 million. Half of it is owned by Norway, population 4.5 million. The British side of the North Sea oil fields peaked in 1999. They became net importers of energy in 2005. That's how fast they went from peak to having to import energy. And another interesting point about this, the North Sea was one of the last great oil regions to be found, to be discovered, and to be exploited. And, of course, because it happened so late in the game, they used the latest and greatest technology to get the oil out. Well, welcome to the diminishing returns of technology, because the main result of using the latest and greatest technology is that we only depleted the North Sea more efficiently. And that's going to be the case in all the places where we apply the latest and greatest technology. It was true in Mexico, discovered the Cantarell field, discovered in 1976, using all the latest and greatest technology, nitrogen injection into the rock, injecting seawater into the rock, horizontal drilling. They did a great job of draining the Cantarell field. Kuwait is past peak. Iran is past peak. Venezuela past peak. Indonesia, one of the great oil regions of the world and one of the earliest ones to be exploited, the basis of Royal Dutch Shell's industry, all their wealth. Indonesia, which is an OPEC member, became a net oil importer 2 or 3 years ago. 10 years from now, it's going to take about half of the world's remaining export capacity just to satisfy U.S. needs if there's no increase in U.S. consumption, which, of course, is unlikely to happen. And net exports from all the exporting nations are going to go to zero in at least 24 years. But you can sort of forget that as the end date, because all kinds of instabilities are going to present themselves long before that happens. Okay, the second other big part of the oil story is called resource nationalism. And it means much tighter terms and conditions and totally and radically altered financial landscape that is totally and radically altered, especially in the oil markets. The old major oil companies are now the new midgets. ExxonMobil, Shell, Total, etc., are only responsible for 5% of the world's oil. The rest of it comes from the nationalized oil companies, Pemex in Mexico, Aramco, Saudi Arabia, Petrobras, Brazil, the Venezuela National Oil Company, Kuwait, etc., etc. And what this represents is a new power shift and a new equation of geopolitical limits that are also factored in with geological limits. And this new situation is going to destabilize the oil markets even more as we see a realignment of political interests with Russia, which still has a lot of oil, even though they're past peak and in depletion, aligning themselves for the sale of their oil with China, with Japan, with their regional interests. You're going to see the husbanding of oil supplies. Some nations will reduce their exports because they're going to realize, you know, this is all the oil we have. You know, we will never have another chance to have this stuff, and we better not just piss it all away. This is a just-in-time system. And in a just-in-time system, small is huge, and small drops in supply will result in very large problems. Supply problems will lead to hoarding, which will be a self-reinforcing feedback loop. The more hoarding there is, the more it will aggravate further hoarding by governments, by corporations, and by individuals. The bottom line of all this is that sooner rather than later, we're probably going to see spot shortages and regional shortages of gasoline and oil products and diesel fuel and aviation fuel in the United States. One of the byproducts of oil nationalism is that more and more the nationalized oil companies, the nations themselves, are making long-term contracts with favored nations rather than putting their oil on the oil markets, on the futures markets, where it's auctioned off to the highest bidder. And then, of course, you have to ask yourself, who are the favored nations in the world? Who are the less favored nations in the world? You know, and who are the friends of the United States who have a lot of oil, who have a high regard for us? It's somewhat problematical. Another enormous problem that is becoming more recognized more and more is that the infrastructure for producing oil is getting older and older and older. It is wearing out the pipelines, the drilling rigs, the refineries. We haven't built any new refineries in the United States for 30 years, and for a very good reason, because they're very expensive to build, and the oil companies in the United States realize that they're in a twilight industry, and they're not going to spend $5 billion building a new refinery when they can spend $5 billion buying back their own stock and jacking up the price of their stock, because it's a twilight industry. Despite everything they say, you know, on the op-ed page of the New York Times, in that little box below the op-eds, you know, despite all the stuff they say there, they can see the end of the oil industry, so they're not making these investments. They will add to some of their refineries. They'll build more pipes and a few more, you know, crackers, but they will not build new ones. And, of course, there's also the NIMBY problem. Nobody wants to have a new refinery anywhere, so even if they were interested in doing it, they wouldn't do it. So that's not happening. Okay. I want to talk about the alternative fuel issue, because the fantasies and delusional thinking that are arising out of that are tremendous. And by the way, the wish for that is understandable. I'm fond of referring to American suburbia as the greatest misallocation of resources in the history of the world. And the reason I call it that is because it's a living arrangement with no future. We've invested all of our national treasure in it, and plus our identity, and that has provoked a powerful psychology of previous investment, which prevents us from thinking about letting go of it. And so all you really hear is, how are we going to keep running it? Energy independence is a fantasy in the context of how we're living now. And when you hear people talk about it, I want you to remember that they are fantasizing. We are going to be very disappointed by what alternative energy will really do for us. For the most part, the scale issue is not being considered at all. I hear about these things all the time, you know, about new schemes and new projects. Yes, you can run a lot of things on different kinds of fuels, you know, on used French fried potato oil and coal liquids and, you know, any of these things. Can you do it for 100 million cars or 250 million cars and trucks? Of course not. And that's where a lot of these things fail. And the same thing is true of wind and solar. Personally, I believe that we're going to use all these things, by the way, but we're going to probably use them at a much smaller scale, a much more modest scale than people really are willing to think about. I think we're going to see wind and solar used on basically a household basis, perhaps on a neighborhood basis, probably not on a grid basis. I think one of the biggest problems as far as the public discussion goes is that there is no other theme that is coming up for discussion, except for one theme. And the theme is, how are we going to keep running our cars by other means? That's all the newspapers are talking about. That's all the blogs are talking about. And the conferences, that, including the environmental conferences, that's all they're talking about. You know, people come up to me after college, blab all the time, and say, I got a Prius. I got a Prius. And they don't get it. You know, the problem is not the kind of cars we're running. The problem is we're driving incessantly all kinds of cars. And it really doesn't matter what kind of car you're driving. We just have to get used to the, and by the way, the car is going to be a diminished presence in our lives, whether we like it or not. You know, despite the ideology, this is very interesting. You know, the main ideology of the New York Times in these matters for the last 5 years has been basically articulated by David Brooks. And that idea is that American suburbia is okay because people like it. And we're going to find out something new, that actually the American people will do what circumstances compel them to do. Not, it's not going to be about whether they like it or not, and it's going to be a very harsh discovery. So it's very important when you go back to your meetings in your own home regions and towns, when you hear that discussion come up about the car and how great it is that we can drive hybrids and plug-ins, we got to talk about other things. We got to stop the conversation about the cars because it's a waste of time. We also face a broad range of scarcities of other resources, particularly mineral resources, including uranium, by the way, and a lot of exotic metals that are even needed to fabricate the equipment for running alternative energy, like the exotic metals that are needed to make wind turbines and solar panels and all of that stuff. That's going to be an additional problem. I said a little while ago that the complex systems that we rely on are facing instability and perhaps even collapse. Finance is the leading one right now, and I think that it's important to discuss this, and it's pretty interesting, you know, because the main implication of the whole peak oil story is that economies like our great industrial economy, these economies are probably not going to be producing the kind of wealth that they have been used to producing for 200 years. You know, between 2.5% and 7% a year in cycles regularly. And so that all the assumptions that lie behind the financial instruments that are sold, created, and traded, namely stocks, bonds, and, you know, the more exotic ones, these instruments are going to lose their legitimacy as people they start to recognize that we are not going to enjoy regular growth. In fact, we are going to be in a contracting economy. And personally, my personal theory is one of the reasons you're seeing so much mischief in the financial sector now is because at some level they have recognized this, and because regular means of creating wealth are losing their legitimacy, they have created artificial means of creating wealth, basically by fraud, by creating collateralized debt obligations and mortgage-backed securities and instruments which are proving right now that they have no value, and that's what is threatening the financial system. Because it's not about illiquidity, it's about the inability to create any more wealth. And it's about money evaporating and vanishing into a black hole and never coming back again. This is going to have a big effect on you because you rely very heavily on large-scale structured financing. I'm going to talk about that in a moment. The food system is another very, very important complex system. Obviously, we depend on this. It is getting into tremendous trouble already. We're seeing that in the rise of commodity prices, corn, soybeans, wheat, reaching price levels that are unprecedented just in the last 6 months. And partly because of our own desperation in creating the ethanol alternative fuel program in order to set up a competition between gas tanks and people eating. And that is now reverberating through the world. You know, we're going to see another one of the complex systems that is now shuddering is the transportation system. And the least of it right now is that is because people are paying $3.50 a gallon for gas. The airlines in this sector are really the canaries in the coal mine. How many of you flew here? And how many of you fly a lot? Have you noticed how unreliable the airlines are and what trouble they're in? And they have like no employees anymore? No, there are no gate agents anymore. Basically, the janitor comes out of the plane now to take your ticket, because they're the only employees who are left on the ground. Three airlines went out of business in the last week. Aloha in Hawaii, bankrupt. ATA, bankrupt. And Skybus, announced yesterday, bankrupt. So they are going down. And this is going to have enormous consequences. And among other things, it is going to lead to a collapse of the tourist industry as we know it, which is another thing which, to some extent, the new urbanism is linked into. So this leads, of course, to something that I have been saying a lot on the circuit, but I'll repeat it again because it is important. We desperately need to rebuild the railroad system in America, or we're not going to go anywhere. We're not going to move anything anywhere. The airline systems are not going to... They're not going to be there for long-range travel. And it shows how unserious we are as a people that we're not even talking about it. And it's the one project that we could do right away that would have the greatest impact on our oil use. The infrastructure's lying out there rusting in the rain, waiting to be fixed. It would put scores of thousands of people to work at good jobs. And it's the one project that we could do right away that would help us develop a sense of competency and confidence that we can actually accomplish something in the face of all these problems. So it's terribly important that we make it part of the political conversation. And those of you who have connections to politicians need to lobby for this because nobody else is doing it. It's got to start, every little group has got to start talking about this problem. The truckers, by the way, went on an informal strike last week. You know, they didn't announce it with a great fanfare, but it was an informal job action because, you know, they make a delivery. They take a bunch of freight, 900 miles. It costs them $1,500 to make the trip, and they get paid $1,200 because they're going to be going down too. another very, very important thing. We're going to have to reactivate the infrastructure, the harbors and waterfronts of our towns and cities. They cannot just be considered as condominium sites. We have to put back the infrastructure for maritime trade because we're not going to be sending the freight by air, and we need to send more things by ship, especially if we're going to be trading with other nations. We have to put back the piers. We have to put back the wharves and the warehouses and the sleazy accommodations for the sailors. So the waterfronts cannot be used just for bike trails and parks and condominium sites and other leisure time-oriented kind of things. I want to address last the issue of scale and sort of the short to midterm destiny of cities and towns. We hear a lot about, you know, the real estate news on cable news and on the internet and in the newspaper about what's going on in the real estate scene. And there's a general agreement among the people who work in that industry, you know, that we're reaching or getting toward the bottom of the cycle. And like all cycles, we'll get to the bottom eventually, and then we'll head back up the slope, up to the more hopeful end of the cycle. And I don't think that that is what you're going to see, and I think you need to prepare yourself for that. It's not the end, it's not a downturn in the cycle. It's the end of the general project of suburbia in our culture. It's the end of that project. We're not going to be doing it anymore because it is going to coincide with a very severe energy problem that will simply make it impossible. It's coming off the menu. Okay? For the last 17 years or so, we've all engaged in a very robust argument, debate between conventional suburbia and the remedy for it, the new urbanism. But from now on, the new urbanism is going to be the only urbanism, because the kitchen is not going to be cooking the conventional one anymore. You have to tell the waiters to tell the diners that they're not serving conventional suburbia anymore, and you're the only ones who are producing anything. So what will be the condition, the shape of the city? I think that you're going to see something very interesting and shocking and surprising. You're going to see the reversal of the 200-year trend of people moving from the farms to the big cities, from the small towns to the big cities, because the great metroplexes are going to fail. They are not appropriately scaled to the energy diet that we are going to be living on in the future. The cities that are composed more of suburban fabric and automobile-dependent fabric are the places that are going to get into the biggest trouble. The cities are not going to grow. Contrary to most of the fantasies that I hear, and by the way, I'm not even convinced that the population is going to grow. That's another assumption that we've heard a lot about. But I want to remind you of something. You know, when the former Soviet Union collapsed, there was a significant drop in the population of more than 20 million people. And you know what? There were no headlines in the New York Times every day. You didn't pick up the New York Times and see a headline that said, another million people disappear from Russia this week. Just in the course of a decade, that's what happened with attrition at the margins of the population, where the people weren't doing too well, because the social safety net had failed, because so many people had made the tragic decision to become winos or vodka drinkers in an extreme way. They just died. So I think that you will not see the cities grow. I think what you're going to see is that the American cities are going to contract, and not necessarily in an orderly process, because that's another assumption. I hear it all the time at the global warming conferences and the climate and the environmental conferences. In fact, I've run into two different sort of major groups of people on the road. There's a group of people who think we're going to tech our way out of this problem, and then there's a group of people who think we're going to organize our way out of this problem. And what I think you're going to see is that there's actually going to be quite a bit of turbulence that will not be taken care of by either group. The cities are going to contract substantially, in my opinion. That's just my opinion. They're going to contract, and they're going to densify at their centers and their waterfronts, if they're lucky to have waterfronts. And everything beyond the center and the waterfronts is really, we don't know what's going to happen with that. But it probably has three different possible destinies: slums, ruins, or salvage. There are a couple of big issues, I think, for the CNU, and I'm not going to belabor them. I'm just going to mention them in the expectation that you will begin your own conversation about it. One of them is the scale of development that you're used to, and the models and equations that you have very laboriously constructed over this 20-year period, and the methodologies that go along with them. I think that the scale of financing is going to be much reduced. It is going to be very, very modest, because we're in a situation right now where wealth is just hemorrhaging from American society, and it is never coming back again. And it is about to engulf the real estate investment trusts. The housing fiasco is now being followed by a commercial real estate fiasco. And by the way, there's another implication for that for the CNU. Do not make heroic plans for retail, for the retail components of anything you do. Because we don't need, you know how over-retailed we are? We don't need a single extra souvenir spoon shop in America, let alone a chain store that sells pants or any other thing. We have too many of those, and they're not all going to become evangelical roller rinks. If you do anything, and I know this is really going to sound really cracked to you, but replace your retail fantasies with some new dreams about adding an agricultural component to the new urbanism, because that's likely to be much more important. Because the blue light special shopping fiesta is now going to fade into the background of American life, and it's not going to be coming back. The other issue, I think, is the scale of an increment of development and what will become the new normal increment of development, because we've been used to seeing all the 400-acre projects and the 1,000-acre projects. And the work has been wonderful. You know, I think life is tragic. I know I've said that more than once. Life is tragic. And I think that what we're going to see is that a lot of the work of the new urbanism of the last 20 years will take the form, it will, in retrospect, we will view it as transitional work between one place where we were, that was a very difficult place that wasn't working right, and a new place that we were thrust into against our wishes. So what is the new increment of development going to be? You know, I don't think that we will be doing the 400-acre projects. I don't think the financing is going to be there for the 400-acre projects. I think you should start searching very carefully for doing a different kind of work. And, of course, the logical place to look for that is going to be in the small towns and the smaller cities that may be scaled appropriately to the energy diet of the future. And, you know, the cities, the places that are going to be successful are also going to be the places that have a meaningful relationship with some kind of an agricultural hinterland. And the places that where that's not possible are going to be a problem. You know, Tucson, Flagstaff, Phoenix, Sedona, Palm Springs are going to dry up and blow away. And I'm sorry to say that, but I think it's the truth. And I think we have to face it. And, of course, the good news is, in Las Vegas, the excitement will be over. Except for the tarantulas. Plenty of excitement for them. And I want to leave you with one thought, which is the same thought that I actually try to leave the college kids with, because they're so preoccupied with it. And I hope I don't sound like I'm condescending, but it's the issue of hope. And hope is a very big political theme this year, as we know, those of us who have been following the primary campaign. Hope is a very big theme. And the college kids always ask me if I can give them hope. They always say, can I give you hope? And it reminds me of going to the conference on the American city at Yale, you know, about 14 years ago. How many academics here? Oh, are you too timid to raise your hands, or? Because this was, this was an amazing spectacle of the academics hosing each other. It was really fabulous. They got up. This was at the beginning. We were on the upscale of the political correctness movement, which was, by the way, generated by our generation. Okay, we came up with that. I don't know how we came up with that, but it was really amazing. And so one after another, the urban planning professors got up and said, we can solve all the problems of the city by giving the poor people self-esteem. So then it was my turn, and I said, we should give people cocaine. Because it makes you feel great about yourself without accomplishing anything. So, the question, and a lot of people tell me, oh, well, your book, The Lung Emergency, is a very hopeless book, made me despondent, you know. But it's very important for you guys to know that you are the generators of hope. You generate it yourself by proving that you can interpret the signals that are coming at you from reality correctly, and that you can respond to them intelligently. And there's a lot that we can do to respond to the problems that are coming at us. And we don't have time to be crybabies or finger pointers or fascists. And of course, that's a big, you know, that's a big problem, because one of the things you're going to see is that the American public, after about 30, 40 years of being amazingly complacent and passive, are going to find themselves in terrible trouble, and they're going to beg somebody to push them around. I'm not kidding. They're going to beg somebody to push them around, to direct their behavior in a purposeful way, after spending 40 years in Las Vegas looking at internet porn for 12 hours a day and doing all the other things that Americans now do, you know, filling their motorboat gas tanks. You know, they're going to need somebody to push them around. We don't want that to happen. So if you want to be hopeful about your country, you have to prove that you have to generate hope by proving you're competent. And one of the ways we can do this collectively, by the way, is to rebuild the national railroad system. So that's very important that you get that message out there. So I expect that you guys will be among the leading generators of hope, because you've been so good at it for the last 20 years, and I'm so proud to be a member of this organization. And thank you very much, and good luck.
Jim, I forgot, what's the name of your new book?
Oh, thank you. I want to give you a little advertisement, sorry, a little commercial. I wrote a new book. It's a novel called World Made by Hand, and I wrote it because I wanted to provide a vivid picture in fiction of what one possible outcome might be of the problems we're moving into. I hasten to add, it's not the only scenario. It's just one that happened to, you know, when you write a novel, it tends to be a self-organizing, emergent thing. And you set some things into motion, and they naturally follow. And that's what I did with this book. But for your interest, it's available out there. And I guess I'm going to be signing some if you want to buy some.